This is the question and answer portion of the Harvard Law School Forum on the Constitutional Crimes of Bush and Obama. Both speakers, Bruce Fenn and Ralph Nader, responded to audience queries.
Hi, my name is John Nalls. Harvard 60 and then the University of Da Nang graduate school. And I also, in that process, swore an oath to the God of my understanding to uphold, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. My question to you gentlemen is, I'm a member of the Smedley D. Butler chapter of Veterans for Peace, the Marine general that was basically written out of history because he told it like it was. But I have it on my back. If war is a racket, which I know it is for a fact, then logically, the government that sends them on these rackets has to be a criminal enterprise. My question is, how can we expect a criminal enterprise to police itself?
Well, the first thing you do is you make sure that no one is elected to Congress who won't insist on impeaching a president who usurps the right of Congress to decide. I could guarantee you, I'd wager my entire state, if the Congress of the United States was told, you have to decide today whether our troops stay in Afghanistan, they wouldn't put them, they wouldn't vote for it. They wouldn't vote for them being in Iraq or anyplace else. And the only way you're going to restrain a president is the Congress says, you do that, you will be impeached and removed. It was quite telling being involved in the Nixon impeachment, even though the articles were only voted on by the Judiciary Committee and resigned before it went to the full House and then a trial in the Senate, that the deterrent effect of that example was still resonant in the Reagan administration. Hey, that would be impeachable. Now, it's a joke. No one even, you think of impeachment as like it's an assassinated coup d'etat, we can't even think of that. Yeah? In fact, it was Ben Franklin at the Constitutional Convention said impeachment is a surrogate for assassinations. It's the way in which you do things legally when you no longer can trust an executive branch to honor his oath of office. And that's up to you to make certain you run for office and you write your congressman every single day. You have to decide whether our troops are in Afghanistan. You have to decide whether our troops are going to Iraq. You can't delegate and give it away. And if you do, you're out of office. That is the only way those members will pay attention to a voice. They don't read anymore. They can't comprehend much of anything. But they're one thing they're preoccupied with, staying in office. And even with all of the power of Wall Street supporting the TARP bailout, I was in the House of Representatives, the first vote on TARP that went down. And the reason why they rejected all of the lobbyists at the time, I could see emails, faxes, phone calls, tens, thousands every hour came in. Members got frightened, said, well, you know, if I have to choose between my reelection and Lockheed or Citibank, I need to stay in office. And then when it stopped, then they went back and fell into the hands of the lobbyists. Mm-hmm. Now, I know it seems probably the audience, well, this is just fairy tale. You know, one citizen can't make a difference. But one citizen can make a difference if it's persistent and it sets in motion kind of collaborative effort that democracies thrive on. When Rosa Parks went to the back of the bus, you think she said, ah, no, tomorrow we'll have a desegregated society. This is great.
She refused to go to the back of the bus.
But anyway, that is what's needed in order to prevent the criminal enterprise from ever being launched.
Yeah. For Mr. Nader, do you have any in mind any like strategies that people could use, given that there is so much concentrated power that happens to be entrenched, and it seems as though if we're relying on things like democratic agency, a lot of us have in the back of our mind that most people don't care. So maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but is there any specific strategic?
Well, first of all, 1% of the people who care can turn around the country if they reflect what Abraham Lincoln called the public sentiment. So you don't have to have tens of millions of people. Second, Bruce is right. Congress really is a pivot. It's the one organization that has the most power under the Constitution and can either open the doors or close the doors on a society. That means 535 men and women who put their shoes on every morning the way you and I do. That means 535 vulnerable people if the voters give a cutting edge. So I think the next stage of the Occupy movement should be to zero in on each one of those 535 members, starting with their district offices. You'll see Congress is under the control of corporations for the most part, but they're easily frightened by the public when it's aroused. And you could see that after the Watergate, remember the firing of the Attorney General by Nixon. 40,000 telegrams came into one senator's office in Tennessee, conservative senator, just in 3 days. Those are the days they had telegrams. So the strategy is to focus on Congress. The other point that's key is the moral authority of law students bleeds on the moral authority of the faculty. You get more and more people from the law schools standing up. You are the sentinels, aren't you? You're the first responders for the rule of law. It'll begin rolling forward into other areas and other professions. There are a lot of retired military and intelligence and diplomatic people who are sick to their stomach as to what they're seeing in the last 10 years. It's too bad Tony Schaefer was not here. He saw the massacres. He was there when he said to the fighter planes, don't hit that building, it's a madrasa. And the missile hit the building and slaughtered everybody in it, the school. And so once the groundswell builds up, you'll see a lot of establishment figures who are retired and free to talk and whose patriotism is never going to be impeached by these draft-dodging neocons in Washington. They will begin swelling. This can all happen very rapidly, and of course, that'll get more media.
You said 1% of the country can change, the trajectory of politics as long as it agrees with public sentiment. Well, today there was a report published showing that a poll of Americans showed that 80% of Americans support the killing of Al-Awlaki and support our drone war, including 55%. So my question to you guys is, cheer me up. I mean, basically, what are we to do with that?
You can't get discouraged by those numbers. No great movement in the history of civilization ever would have begun if the first person who said slavery was evil said, but it's not going to be abolished tomorrow. Because the struggle for justice is its own reward. Whether it happens in your lifetime or not doesn't matter. The struggle for women's franchise was 1848, Seneca Falls. Susan B. Anthony was dead, still didn't have the 19th Amendment. So, of course, it's discouraging. That's why we are where we are,
it's
at a constitutional crisis.
It's not even that discouraging, because one of the great elements of due process is called cross-examination. And there was never any argument publicly reaching all these people polled as to why they should have another opinion. So, obviously, if a prosecutor comes into a courtroom and with all the evidence, there's no counter evidence, and there's no appeal to the rule of law and due process, they would come out that way. Take a look at the other polls where people do have some knowledge and experience. 82% of the American people think the country's going in the wrong direction. 75% of the American people think corporations have too much control over their lives. 62% of the American people believe the two major parties are failing them. So you see, that comes from a background of a little knowledge and experience in the marketplace and so on.
And if they would have followed that question with, and would you have been in favor of that if in the next week they vaporized his 16-year-old son, then I think the numbers would be twisted because they didn't think about what the implications are. You wanted to vaporize a 16-year-old as innocent as the white snow.
Back there.
Yes, I admire both of you folks. It's great. I'd like to see that duplicated around the country by many people. And I was a political associate and friend of one of your former running mates, Peter Kamel, you for 2 decades.
Yes.
Now, what I'd like to know is this, why not look at the whole class structure? This is a system of capitalism, beat working them up.
Well, you'll see my references in my prior remarks alluded to a lot of that. It's all a seamless web, isn't it? It all connects together. Concentration of power radiates in all directions. The abuses that attend it radiate. The more unaccountable they are, the more devastating the consequences. And so we're seeing declining livelihoods for 80% of the American people in real terms since 1973, unemployment and poverty and child poverty and so forth. So anybody who says we don't have class warfare from the top down is not...
No, in fact, James Madison in Federalist 10 describes the most prominent source of factions as unequal distributions of property, so it's not a novel idea. Let's take the last question from this young lady here.
I'd just like to bring up the imminency of the situation now being a war threat with the Syria-Iran situation, the push for, well, the sanctions on Iran, the recent UN resolution, which Susan Rice said that China and Russia had blood on their hands because they didn't want to overthrow Assad. And you guys have been talking about, you know, the crimes of Bush and Obama, and that's true, they're there, and he should be impeached right now. But it's also a matter of avoiding thermonuclear war. So I just wanted to bring that issue up.
Well, I don't think that's true, that it's a matter that we have to invade Iran to avoid a thermonuclear war. The neocons say, for the first time in the history of the world, we have a regime that craves self-destruction. They want to die immediately to get to 77 virgins in heaven. Does that make any sense?
No.
The Soviets flinched with the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Iranians, even the mullahs, they negotiated the release of the hostages. When we shot down a civilian passenger, killed almost 300 civilians, they negotiated reparations. They ended the Iraq-Iran war. They didn't insist on committing suicide, in which they could do very conveniently by jumping into the Tigris or Euphrates and drowning, if that was what their craving was. No, we don't applaud nuclear proliferation, but we are the only country that's used nuclear weapons. We have vastly more than anyone else, and you could imagine why. Iran might say, well, you can have all these thousands of nuclear weapons, and Russia can, and Israel can, and Pakistan and India, and somehow international law says we're the only ones that can't even have a capability? That's even-handed justice? Doesn't look a little bit peculiar? We invaded we overthrew their government in 1953 with Mossadegh. But to go back to the point, this idea that nuclear deterrence doesn't work is ridiculous. It's worked flawlessly ever since World War II. We're the only ones that used it when there wasn't any other nuclear power in the world. And so don't buy this idea that unless we invade Iran, we'll all be in a nuclear winter. That's what the neocons continue to focus on in order to get us to give up our liberty.
Just one more.
I'm going to have to go.
Yeah, just one.
Well,
James?
Bruce, I think the question was really that the invasion of Iraq risks provoking nuclear. The invasion of Iran risks provoking nuclear.
Oh, if we did that, yeah, that would, rather than the other way around.
All right, so I would like to thank both Ralph and Bruce and you all for coming.
Okay, we need to go. I've got to check for that.
If you want to come and get copies of this,
yeah.
Here they are.
This concludes the forum on America's Lawless Empire, the Constitutional Crimes of Bush and Obama, with speakers Ralph Nader and Bruce Fenn. The event was held in Austin Hall at Harvard Law School on February 8, 2012. Recorded by Chuck Rosina for the Boston Community Reporters Project.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Jordan.